Weary of myself and sick of asking what I am and what I ought to be, at the vessel's prow I stand, which bears me forwards, forwards, o'er the starlit sea.
The French Lieutenant's Woman by John Fowles. Dramatized by Frederick Bradnam. With David Threlfall as Charles Smithson, Amanda Redman as Sarah Woodruff, and Norman Rodway as the writer. Episode 3.
Charles, returning to Exeter, was joined by myself as the train left London. I am, of course, a stranger to him. But before the train halts at Exeter Station, we must begin this episode with a brief visit to Sarah Woodruff, where, a few days earlier, she is in her small sitting room at Endicott's Family Hotel. The purse Charles gave her contained 10 sovereigns, and she has been on her first ever shopping expedition. She has just unwrapped a nightgown and a dark green shawl, merino fringed with emerald green silk, which she holds in a strange sort of trance against her cheek. Another parcel contains a roll of bandage, which she places in a drawer. There are footsteps in the passage outside, and she stops still. But the footsteps pass on. She makes herself some tea and prepares to wait for as long as she has to.
Exeter's escaping! Exeter!
I wonder what awaits us in Exeter.
What was that, sir?
I wish you a pleasant journey to Lyme, sir.
Oh, thank you. It looks like rain.
It does. Nevertheless, I shall walk to Endicott's. It is no distance. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Mr. Charles, will we stay in the night, Mr. Charles?
No.
Yes, rather. I fancy it will rain. We'll put up at the ship.
Right, sir. I'll get the baggage.
I think I will stretch my legs after the journey. You go on with the baggage.
Yes, Mr. Charles. Shall I give orders for dinner?
I'll see when I come in. I may attend evensong at the cathedral.
Then their rain clouds could break, sir.
A little rain won't hurt me.
Yes, Mr. Charles.
Oh! Here we are, young man. The ship will tell.
Thanks. Cabby, you heard of the Endicott's Hotel?
Endicott? Aye.
Good. Then you wait here while I get the staff here running about. Then you can take me near to it.
That's it. Looks a bit of a dump. Still, she can't have much of the ready. Unless he were generous. Here's a nice doorway. Wait and watch. Stretching his legs, was he, eh? Going to evensong, was he? Well, I wonder. Anyway, we'll soon know if I've beat him to it. Hello? Is this him? Yeah, it is him. He's got a kid to show him the way.
Thank you, youngster. Here.
Oh, thank you, sir.
And off goes the kid. Come on, Mr. Charles. Looking the place up and down. Don't hesitate, in you go. That's it. Good fella. I'll give him 1/4 hour. Longer and he's up to no good, I'll bet on it.
Miss Woodruff, oh, the poor young lady, sir.
What has happened?
She was coming downstairs day before yesterday morning, and she slipped, sir.
Oh,
she turned her ankle something horrible. All swollen up it was. I wanted the doctor, but she won't hear of it.
Oh, then I cannot see her.
Oh, bless me. Of course you can. I'll send the girl up with your name, sir. Oh. Betty Ann!
Here is my card.
Oh. Yes, ma'am?
Take this gentleman's card up to room 9. Miss Woodruff.
Room 9, Miss Woodruff.
Will you not sit down, sir?
Thank you, no. I have been sitting since early today.
Are you from London, sir?
Yes, I came down on the 10 o'clock from Paddington.
You're a relative, I take it, sir?
No, I have to see Miss Woodruff on a business matter.
Are you a gentleman of the law, sir?
Yes, of the law.
She's such a gentle young woman, but such sad eyes.
I hardly know her. Oh, here's your girl back.
She says, will you go up, sir?
Well, show the gentleman the way, girl.
Thank you.
Miss Woodruff's at the top, sir.
These are steep stairs, are they not?
Oh, they're in that, sir. They make me puff like. And it's a wonder we don't fall down them a lot more often. This be the spot, sir, where Miss Woodruff did fall.
Is her ankle still painful?
Don't know that, sir. But she has them bandaged up and won't let no doctor near. Long here, sir. Room 9. This be it. She said to knock and go in. The gentleman, miss.
I was passing through Exeter on my way back to Lyme.
Yes, you went to London. Are you well?
Yes, I'm very well, thank you. Your ankle, can you move?
I can hobble no more.
Are you in pain?
A little. To do such a thing, to be so foolish.
Be thankful that it did not happen on Ware Commons.
Yes.
This is a very pretty shawl.
I bought it the day before my fall. You were most generous.
You have communicated your address to Miss Tranter?
No.
Only to myself. That is what I have come to discuss. Please do not cry. The shawl suits you. It brings out the colour of your hair. I should not have come.
I thought never to see you again.
I thought I would not see you again. I meant not to.
But you have.
Now I have. I dare not look at you.
I can look at you, though.
I came because I cannot lose you. I see you in my mind's eye all the time. You haunt me.
So, now you must look at me. Please.
You see, I drown in your eyes. Let me hold you.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, how small you are. How beautiful.
In your arms I feel beautiful.
Oh, Sarah.
This is our moment.
This is madness. Wonderful, wonderful madness.
My ankle. You must carry me.
Yes. 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 I want you. I must have you.
Then do what you want with me.
Oh, my dear. My dear. Oh, my sweetest angel.
Sarah lay as if frozen in delight, There was no delight for Charles, and no post-coital sadness either, but an immediate and awful horror. All was destroyed, all principle, all faith, all honourable intent, all future. And yet he lay in the sweetest possession of his life.
I am worse than the French lieutenant.
Do not speak. Do not.
I must. What is to become of us?
I cannot think beyond this moment.
I must break my engagement.
I ask nothing of you.
Sarah. It is the sweetest name.
I know you cannot marry me.
But I wish to. I must.
No. I am not fit to be your wife.
My dearest, that is untrue.
No, true. And she must love you.
I no longer love her. If I ever have.
But she is worthy of you. I am not.
You smile at your own words. Why, Sarah?
Because I am content. But not worthy of you, that is all.
Are you telling me? How can I go away as if nothing has happened between us?
You can.
How can I? It is impossible. I do not understand.
You will.
Then you can forgive me so much and ask so little.
Because I love you and there is nothing to forgive.
I need time to think.
Now I know there was a day when you loved me. I can bear anything.
I do not understand. I need time to think. And I must get dressed. My manservant will wonder. Give me a day or two's grace. I must get dressed.
Now you will see, Charles, that I am not worthy of you.
What was that? Good Lord, there's blood on my shirt tails. Have I cut myself? No. There's no cut. Nothing.
No, you are not cut, Charles.
Then what the deuce? You were a virgin. Were you? You lied to me. The French lieutenant lies. Everything has been based on a lie.
I said I was not worthy of you, did I not?
Was there a Frenchman? Did you go to Weymouth?
Barguin was real. He flattered me. I went to Weymouth. I saw him with a woman of a certain kind. I came away.
You came away? Is that all?
It is raining. I must close the window.
Your ankle. My God, that too.
That too. I shall not trouble you again.
Look at me. Turn and look at me.
I have deceived you in many ways. I'm sorry.
What have I done, for God's sake, to deserve such deception?
Nothing. You have given me the consolation of believing that in another world, another age, another life, I might have been your wife. And you have given me the strength to go on living in the present.
Those are your reasons for deceiving? But why? I still ask you why you did so.
I do not know. It is a mystery to me. I cannot explain it.
You cannot explain it? I cannot accept that.
I think I loved you from the moment I first saw you. That was no deceit. Please go now. I shall never disturb your life again.
You leave me without words to express. I don't know what. But I risked a great deal for you, and I find I was made the dupe of your fantasy, your imagination.
Please say no more. Please leave me.
Well, perhaps after all you are mad.
No. I am far stronger than you or any man can comprehend. That is not madness, Mr. Smithson. Goodbye.
So, this is my reward.
We must not quarrel. Only understand there can be no happiness for you with me. I beseech you. Leave me.
Goodbye, Miss Woodruff.
He walked blindly away from the hotel through a new downpour of rain. He noticed it no more than where he was going. His great desire was darkness, oblivion in which to regain calm. He took an abrupt downhill street towards the River X. At the bottom was a small redstone church, and he felt suddenly the need for sanctuary. The church was open, but deserted.
Our Father, who art in heaven, forgive me, O Lord, for my selfishness. Forgive me my dishonor. Forgive me my unchastity. Forgive and advise me, O Lord, in my travail. Oh, it is impossible. Impossible. For all I see is her face. Not yours, Christ. But what have I done?
Oh, stop wishing. You have not done it. The act was performed.
But I was deceived. She said so. Surely if she had truly loved me, she could not have let me go. I cannot grasp the reason why she deceived. From the time she sat with her back to me in that wilderness and told me the story of the French lieutenant, a lie. The days in the wilderness were mine also. I have given Ernestina my solemn promise and broken it. How do I mend it? How can I ever wash the blood from my loins? Is it her freedom Sarah wants? She loves me, but she loves her freedom even more. So what right had she to put me on the rack every night? And have I not put Ernestina on the rack? And when I return to her, will she know that she is not truly loved? Hopeless. It is hopeless.
Was Charles crying because deep in his heart he did not wish to be an agnostic, weeping not for Sarah, but for his own inability to speak to God?
Console me, Jesus, for if I leave my prison of duty, honor, self-respect, if I break free, I too shall be crucified by the age I live in. Come down from your cross and bring this age love and freedom and compassion. And I, of course, must do this for myself. I see now that I must go into the future with Sarah on my arm. I must ignore the conventions, the cries of outraged disapproval, the crucifixion of my self-respect. I must return to Sarah, to her compassion and love. And our freedom.
So Charles returned to his hotel to wash his shirt best he could in his tub and consider his future's freedom. First thing in the morning, he wrote a long letter to Sarah in which he declared his love and said that his future had to be with her. He added that if she did not return his letter, he would know that she would wait for him while he concluded things in Lyme as he must. Sam took the letter to Endicott's family hotel and came back empty-handed. They set off for Lyme at once, Charles travelling with a mixture of emotions which ranged from the profoundly happy via the guilty to a sense of utter desperation at the step he had to take in Lyme. Sam should perhaps have felt more guilty than he did, but then he thought he had done the right thing. They reached Lyme by the afternoon.
Hello, Mary. Is Miss Tina at home?
She didn't say she weren't, sir. She's in the drawing room, sir.
Charles, Aunt Tranter is out this afternoon, but I will let you come in. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you, Miss Tina. I received a letter from Papa this morning. Charles, is something wrong? Charles.
I beg you to sit down.
There. Why do you look at me like that, Charles?
Because I hardly know how to begin.
Is it Papa?
No, he was kindness itself. But I did not tell him the truth.
The truth? What truth, Charles?
That I have, after the most painful consideration, come to the conclusion that I am not worthy of you.
Charles, you're joking.
To my eternal shame, I am not joking.
You are not worthy of me?
Totally unworthy.
This is some nightmare. Let me wake up.
When I realized last winter that an offer of marriage might be favorably entertained by you, I was tempted by Satan.
Have you gone mad?
I saw an opportunity by a brilliant marriage to re-establish my faith in myself. I have always felt that my life was without purpose. This was not a cold-blooded calculation. I liked you very much. I sincerely believed that this liking would grow into love.
I cannot believe it is you I hear speaking and not some cruel, heartless imposter.
I know this must come as a grievous shock.
As a grievous shock? Shock? How can you stand there so cold and collected and tell me you have never loved me?
I am not seeking to excuse myself. I realize that I was disappointed when your father did not end our engagement, although the realization took a day or so to sink in.
How could you think he would end our engagement?
I admit I was wrong. He understood my changed circumstances. He even proposed that one day I should become his partner in business.
It is because you cannot accept marrying into trade.
I happily accepted that. I was horror-struck at your father's offer, I must admit.
It was trade,
that is
commerce.
Not true, that I swear. What haunts me is the injustice I should be doing by marrying you without the love you so thoroughly deserve.
Deserve? Yes, I have what I thoroughly deserve. I know that to you I have never been anything more than a pretty little piece of drawing-room furniture and a spoilt child. But I am capable of growing up. Do I deserve this? You know that I have been dangled before 100 other men, and I chose you because you seem more generous, wiser, more experienced. And now you say you do not love me, you are not worthy of me. Why? What is the truth behind this? You have not told me the truth, have you? Something happened when you were in Exeter.
I wished to spare you.
Who is she?
Her name is unimportant. I can say no more.
It isn't possible, but it is her, that woman, poor tragedy. No wonder Dr. Grogan was furious, but wouldn't say except she had vanished, and she had help, he said. You, Charles! It was you! It's true, isn't it?
I cannot say. It is unimportant who it is.
Then it is her! A Frenchman's... Oh, you are a monster. You've deceived me. You've been deceiving me for weeks.
No, that is not so.
You have in your heart, and you've broken your solemn promise. There is a remedy for members of my sex.
Well, you have every right to bring such an action.
The world will know you for what you are.
The world will know whatever happens.
My father will drag your name through the mire. You'll be spurned and detested by all who know you. You'll be hounded out of England. You'll be...
I will write at once to your father. Mary, your mistress needs you.
Charles regained his rooms at the White Lion. Sam followed him. The master felt like every traitor since time began. The servant did not feel the same, as perhaps he should have done. In fact, he felt more like a man fighting his way out of a corner.
What the devil do you want, Sam? I did not ring.
It ain't never true, Mr. Charles.
Yes, it is true. Miss Freeman and I are no longer to marry. Now go, and keep your mouth shut.
But Mr. Charles, me and my Mary...
Get out, Sam. I can't think of such matters now.
With respect, sir, I have to consider my situation.
And what may that mean?
Will you be residing in London from henceforth, sir?
Yes, and then I shall probably go abroad. Now let me get on with composing this letter.
Then I won't be accompanying you, sir.
You won't? Why not?
And I'm not coming back with you to Exeter, neither. I'm leaving your employ, as I ought to have done along...
You can go to the devil for all I care.
Well, I don't fancy nowhere, sir, as where I might meet a friend of yours.
You impertinent young wretch.
And if you wishes for attention, pray ring for one of the hotel domestics.
That evening, Charles left Lyme in a four-wheeler, in the slanting late sunlight. His spirits rose as he travelled through the rich green fields and May hedgerows of the Devon countryside. It was difficult not to see the future as fertile. A new life lay ahead of him. Sarah must be suitably installed in London. Then, as soon as his affairs could be settled, they should go abroad, south for the winter, Spain, Granada. And in some jasmine-scented room they would lie awake in each other's arms, infinitely alone, inseparable in exile. Night had fallen when they arrived in Exeter and stopped at Endicott's family hotel. Telling the driver to wait, Charles entered the hotel.
Oh, it's you, sir.
Miss Woodruff expects me. I will find my own way.
The young lady's left, sir.
Left? You mean gone out?
Oh, no, sir, I mean left. Gone. She took the London train this morning.
This morning? The London train?
She told me I am catching the 11 o'clock train to London, and she paid up and left by cab.
But an address? Did she leave no address?
Nothing, sir. Not a line.
And no message left for me?
No. I thought it very likely be you she was going away with, sir.
Ah. Tell me, this morning at around 8, did not a manservant come with a letter for Miss Woodruff?
No, sir. I was here all morning. Opened up at 7:30. No one came with a letter for her. Of that, I'm sure.
Thank you.
Sam! Thief! Betrayer! Spy! He has my letter, and he will have read it. My God, no wonder he left my employment so fast.
Are you getting in, sir?
But I'll find her in London. I must.
What are you saying, sir?
Ah, yes. Take me to the Ship Hotel, will you?
Charles hired four detectives, four of a very new profession, who began by trying the agencies for governesses and the church school boards, while Charles, in a hired carriage, patrolled the genteel poor districts of London. Peckham, Putney-by-the-River, Pentonville, without success. The detectives next tried the booming new female clerical agencies, but there was no trace of Sarah. However, other consequences of his choice of freedom were waiting to extract their toll.
I think, Mr. Montague, that the facts of this abominable breach of engagement are not in dispute.
They're not, Mr. Aubrey.
Your client has himself provided evidence of his own guilt in his letter to Mr. Freeman. Though with the usual impudence of his kind, he makes an attempt at self-exoneration, without reference to the criminal and sordid liaison, which is the blackest aspect of his crime.
My client did not come here to defend his conduct, Mr. Aubrey. He requires your case against him to be put as straightforwardly as is possible.
I will. Mr. Montague, your client may have thought Mr. Freeman not to be fully cognizant of his amours. He's wrong. We know the name of the female. We have witnesses to circumstances I find too disgusting to name.
Allow me a word in private with my client, please.
By all means.
You told me that Miss Freeman guessed who it was. But is it possible that they have evidence?
I'm afraid so. A letter I wrote her was never delivered by my manservant. He stole it instead and must have passed it on for his own advantage.
I see. Charles, I think we should get this over with without wrangles. Oh, do you agree?
Most heartily.
I believe that if you sign an admission of guilt, they won't take us to court. A courtroom trial is a sordid business for both sides.
I'll sign any damn thing.
I, Charles Alderman Henry Smithson, do fully, freely, and not upon any consideration but my desire to declare truth, admit that I contracted to marry Miss Ernestina Freeman, and I did break that contract without any just cause or any justification whatsoever beyond my own criminal selfishness and faithlessness. I entered upon a clandestine liaison with a person named Sarah Woodruff. My conduct throughout this matter has been dishonourable, and by it I have forever forfeited the right to be considered a gentleman. You're signing under duress, Charles. That would not stand up in court.
What does it matter? Go on, please.
There is this last condition. Furthermore, I acknowledge that the injured party may make whatsoever use she desires of this document. You may have to remain a bachelor, Charles.
Do you mean...
Well, Freeman could show the document to the next father-in-law, I mean, if you go in for the marriage game once more.
Oh, it is vile. I am marked and defiled to the end of my life. I wish I were dead.
Let us go in and sign, Charles.
June came, an exceptionally fine one. Charles saw it out, but towards the end of it stopped searching. The detectives searched Exeter, and discreet inquiries were made in Lyme, but all in vain. Charles paid them off and consulted Harry Montague.
I'm thinking of going abroad, Harry.
So you really have given up hope?
She appears to have vanished into thin air.
London is a vast rabbit warren, Charles.
Perhaps I do not want to find her any longer. Perhaps she has died.
It is a possibility I had thought of.
And who would know?
Let me send a clerk to look at the register of deaths.
No, Harry, no, that would be terrible. No.
But the next day he followed this sensible advice. No Sarah Woodruff's death was recorded. He dallied another week, then abruptly decided to go abroad. Here we must leave Charles to begin his travels, and go back a little in time, returning to Lyme, where Sam had played his cards very well. Aunt Tranter had been a soft touch from the start.
I just had to give me notice in, Miss Tranter.
I think it was very brave of you, Sam.
So I've lost all my prospects. And there's Mary.
Whom you want to marry.
Well, she says she'll have me, but how can I...
I am very fond of Mary, you know. I shall look after her marriage to you.
Oh, God bless you, Mom.
And... I know someone here who's looking for a manservant. I will speak for you.
Oh, well, that would be most helpful, Mom.
Mary told me that Mr. Smithson was intending to loan you money, so that you could set yourself up in business.
Well, true as you're standing there, Mom. 400, he said.
And you want to be a haberdasher.
Well, ever since I was a boy, it's been me burning ambition, Mom.
Well, I don't know about a shop, Sam. But as you know, I have a brother-in-law, whom you might say is a draper and haberdasher in a large way.
And he left Smithson's employment because he could not stomach the man's behaviour?
He told me it was because he saw Smithson as behaving most dishonourably to Ernestina. He did try to interfere by not delivering a letter as instructed to Miss Woodruff. His behaviour on that troubles him.
Do you know if he is still in possession of this letter?
I believe he is, Ernest.
When you return to Lyme, Emma, please make arrangements for this manservant to come to London, to the office.
Oh, Ernest.
I will make no promises, but I will have him seen.
We must now jump ahead some 20 months. Charles is in America. Sam and Mary are married and living in a small terraced house in London, a mile to the west of Chelsea. They have a girl child of more than a year, and Mary is some months gone with what Sam hopes will be a baby boy. Sam was given a job at Freeman's Emporia. The undelivered letter helped him here. And since beginning as a window dresser, is flourishing. His salary now risen to the giddy heights of 32 shillings a week. On this late February evening, he is standing in his minuscule front parlour, listening to what Mary has told him, with mixed feelings.
Oh, I haven't taken it in proper, Mary, love. Now, this afternoon...
This afternoon, I went on my walk like you said I must, and I got to the new embankment at Chelsea.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking into the water opposite a street called Cheney Walk, where there's big fine houses in it. I heard a cab pull up just behind me, so, being a nosy Parker, I turned round to see, and she got out.
And you saw her, clear?
Clear as daylight. I didn't want her to see I saw, so I got behind a tree. Had a good look at her as she paid the cabbie, and went up the steps to the front door. Well, she must live there, because she took out a key, opened the front door, and went straight in.
Sarah Woodruff.
She was smartly dressed, Sam. Different to Lyme, in bright colours. But it was her, all right.
Now, what number was the house? Did you get it?
I look special. Number 16.
Good girl. I ought to let him know. I kept that advert he put in the papers to contact his solicitors. And there was that reward. But I couldn't claim it.
Of course, you wouldn't let him know it were me who saw her.
Not exactly. I mean, I won't sign it, nor give an address, nor nothing. But I have to let him know. I owes that to him.
Say there, Mr. Smithson.
Yes?
A cable for you.
Oh, thank you.
From London, England.
She has been found. Montague, London.
The next ship to Europe. Can you find out when she sails?
Sure, I'll get on to the shipping office right away, sir.
Posted in London, Harry.
A West Central postmark. It's not signed, you see. It's addressed to you personally, care of this office.
Mm.
No mention of the reward. Whoever sent it must know you.
And she really does live at 16 Cheney Walk?
We have confirmed it discreetly.
There is nothing for it. I must go there.
By the way, Charles, the Sphinx has turned her name around. She's known as Mrs. Ruffwood, a widow.
Mrs. Ruffwood, a widow? The questions I have to ask her.
Charles, do bear in mind the fate of those who failed to solve the Sphinx's riddle.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I wish to speak to a Mrs. Ruffwood. I believe she resides here.
Can I have your name, please?
My card. Pray tell her I have come a long way to see her.
You'd better come in.
Thank you.
Shut the door, please. Just a moment.
What is it, Jen?
This gentleman wishes to see Sarah, Dante Gabrielle.
Yes, my dear sir, Sarah Ruffwood.
If you would be so good. I knew her well before she came to London. It is a private matter.
Is she upstairs, my dear?
Yes, they talk, that is all.
Then take him up, my dear. Mm. Good afternoon, sir.
Thank you.
It is the first floor.
These, or most of them... are by the Pre-Raphaelites?
Yes, most are.
The gentleman downstairs, he collects.
They're just hung here. Some are his own work.
D.G. Rossetti, W. Holman Hunt, and this JME, is it?
John Everett Millais symbol. I think it's a wonderful painting.
Ah, yes, it is.
Is Mrs. Ruffwood employed here as a governess?
She's no longer a governess.
Ah, I have not seen her for 2 years.
Oh, would you kindly wait here? She's in that room.
A.C. Swinburne, 1860. Who painted him? W. Bell Scott. Miss Siddall, D.G. Rossetti. Dante Gabriel, so that's who he was. Good Lord, isn't that...
I have given her your card.
The gentleman in there is not one Mr. Ruskin.
Yes, John Ruskin. The other is Dante Gabrielle's brother, William Michael. Sarah will be out soon, she said.
Thank you.
This house, these men, what is she here? The Sphinx? All my assumptions are stood on their head. Sarah? Sarah?
How came you here, Mr. Smithson?
I hardly knew you. Your costume. The colours suit you.
I asked how you came here.
Yes, I am sorry. My solicitor received an anonymous letter. It gave this address. I have advertised my search for you.
I know.
And I have searched every corner of the city.
I thought you might do so.
Now I have found you. And you are a different woman.
Life has been kind to me, Mr. Smithson, after much unkindness.
This is a fine house. I had no idea such houses were here in Chelsea. It belongs to Mr. Rossetti?
Yes, to Dante Gabriel and his brother, William Michael. Will you come to the studio?
Yes. Mr. Dante Gabriel Rossetti's wife is dead, I believe.
She is dead, but not in his heart. The studio is here. Do come in. The brothers share the house now. At present, Algernon Swinburne is living here.
The poet?
Yes, that poet.
And you live here?
Yes, I live here. I am Dante Gabriel's amanuensis, his assistant.
Over there, the drawing. Is it of you?
I serve as his model sometimes.
I see.
No, Mr. Smithson, I am not his mistress. Do please sit down. I shall.
I must explain. The last time we saw each other, that evening in Exeter, I wrote you a letter. In it, I said you meant everything to me. To express myself now is all but impossible. I said I could not live without you. I said I wanted to marry you. I said how I loved you.
And what happened to this letter?
My manservant betrayed me. He did not deliver it. He presumably had his own ideas as to my future. I also said that if you did not return the letter, I would know you would wait for me to return from Lyme. As the letter was not returned, I broke my engagement, came back to Exeter, and went to the hotel. And since then, I have never ceased to think of you. Never ceased to love you. Does what I say mean nothing to you?
It means very much to me, but I am at a loss for words.
You told me you loved me.
There was another time when a madness was in me. When I forced myself upon you, knowing you were engaged to be married, knowing I could ruin your life.
It was almost so.
Nothing but you mattered. It was an obsession, a madness. I saw nothing clearly. It was all unreal. Until that time in Exeter. Then I saw I had to destroy what had begun between us, for there was a terrible falsehood to it.
I was not to blame for that.
No, of course not.
Then what you are saying is that you saw me only as a means to an end, that you invaded my very being, knowing you could destroy me?
No, I never meant to destroy you, not even in my madness.
But you made me love you. And is it not true that now you do not care whether or not I still love you?
I care, but can do nothing.
In all my travels, I have not seen a woman to compare with you. You are a remarkable woman, and without you, I am a ghost of myself. You do not know, but I have signed away my good name for you. And I would sacrifice everything I have left for you. Sarah. My dearest Sarah.
It's not fair of you, Mr. Smithson. There is nothing I can do. Nothing.
There is another. Is there?
Yes, there is somebody.
Then I will say good afternoon, Mrs. Bradford.
There is something more I must say. Wait, I beg you.
Have you not said the one thing which matters?
Please listen, please. He is an artist. He wishes to marry me. I respect and admire him both as a man and as an artist, but I shall never marry him. You must believe that. The rival you both share is myself. I do not wish to marry. Your eyes ask me why. They say it is unheard of. Marriage is every woman's goal. It is not mine. Firstly, because I do not want to share my life. I wish to be what I am, not what a husband, oh, however kind, however indulgent, must expect me to become in marriage.
And your second reason?
Cannot you guess? I never expected to be happy in my life, you know that, yet I find myself happy. I have arrived at last where I belong. Think what you will of me, but I cannot wish my life other than it is at present. Do you comprehend me?
I too have changed. I have learnt much of myself. All that you are now, Mrs. Charles Smithson may continue to be. I would not ban you your new world.
No, you are very kind, but you do not understand.
You may reserve to yourself all the mystery you want. It will remain sacrosanct to me.
It is not you I fear. It is your love for me. Nothing can remain sacrosanct there.
How well you have learnt to argue.
I'm sorry if I have annoyed you.
You do realise, do you not, that you have ruined my life, and it seems taken some pleasure in doing so.
I knew nothing but unhappiness could come from this meeting.
So, it was you who sent that letter?
What letter do you mean, Mr. Smithson?
The anonymous one to my solicitor.
How could you think that? How could you?
I know to my cost what an accomplished actress you are. Was I not summoned to be given the coup de grace?
No, never. I never wanted to see you again.
I wish I could believe you. I think you have not only planted the dagger in my breast, you have delighted in twisting it. A day will come when you shall be called to account.
I cannot let you go believing that. There is a lady in this house who understands me better than anyone else in the world. She wishes to see you. Will you see her?
I am astounded. You find a stranger for me to exonerate your behaviour?
She is waiting to see
you. I do not care if it is the Queen herself.
I shall not be present.
Is this yet another of your tricks?
A less honourable gentleman might have guessed some time ago. Now, will you excuse me?
What do you mean by treating it? Is she sending Miss Christina Rossetti to lecture me? The devil she will.
I must speak for the child who now arrives in the arms of Jane, the girl who opened the door to Charles. A little girl with dark hair, a little more than a baby, yet far less than a child.
The lady Mrs. Rufford was sending to me. I trust she will be here shortly.
She's come.
Jane leaves. Charles stares at the child for at least 10 seconds before going to help her stand on unsteady legs. He scans the small face until the child shows signs of not liking his scrutiny, so he produces his watch, as he had once before when left with a child. It has the same good effect, and she takes it in a tiny hand. He carries her to a chair by the window and sits her on his knees. He hears someone come in. The little girl sees it is her mother, lets go the watch and reaches out to her. Sarah lifts her up.
What is her name?
Lalage. Rossetti approached me one day in the street and asked to be allowed to draw me. She was not yet born. He was most kind in every way when he knew of my circumstances. He himself proposed her name. He is her godfather.
It is Greek. From Lalagio. To babble like a brook.
You do not like it?
Oh, it is a pretty name. But what if I had never found you?
It had to be like this.
All those cruel words we spoke.
They had to be spoken.
Shall I ever understand your parables, Sarah? My love. My sweetest, sweetest Sarah.
Charles, my love. Dearest Charles.
In his room downstairs, Dante Gabriel Rossetti speaks to himself. He is coming from a daydream, and notices that the little clock on his desk seems to have gained time. He checks it with his half-hunter. It has gained a quarter of an hour. He puts the clock hands back to the right time, then goes to the door and opens it. Jane is carrying a little girl down the stairs. She smiles at Dante Gabriel.
You've been up to Sarah?
I took Lala to say goodnight, but the door was open. I did not go in.
Is the gentleman proving himself a nuisance, my dear?
I think harsh words have been used, but he will leave soon.
Well, yeah, are you sure?
I could see from Sarah's disposition that their meeting was all but over.
Well, I'm glad of that. Thank you, Jane. Good night, Lala. That was a most peculiar daydream, even for me. And time went mad. A quarter of an hour was gained, and is now put back. Regained. He's someone from Sarah's past, no doubt. The past, which is a closed book. Let us hope he does not return. Sarah knows what she wants from her future better than most. But does he, I wonder?
You have not only planted the dagger in my breast, you have delighted in twisting it. A day will come when you shall be called to account.
Mr. Smithson, is this not proof that we had better never to have set eyes on each other again? Oh,
if I had guessed your real nature was entirely selfish.
If I said, knowing I cannot love you as a wife must, you may marry me, should I not be unselfish?
There was a time when you spoke of me as your one remaining hope in life. Our situations are now reversed, and you have no time for me. Very well, but do not try to defend yourself. Why do you smile?
Why do you take life so seriously?
Why do I... There is a coldness. It's as if you have stripped me naked.
You have done the same to me, Mr. Smithson.
I wish I could understand what your real intentions are.
I have offered you a platonic marriage, have I not?
And I must refuse your offer. I would be a laughingstock in this house, a pet donkey.
Come, Mr. Smithson. You are a superior being. How could you become a pet donkey?
And in truth, you do not want such a marriage, do you?
I have made the offer.
It was a false move, was it not?
I would have stayed with it.
The consequences would be unbearable. You have manipulated me from the first, and it is only now that I know it. Goodbye, Mrs. Ruffin.
Are you fleeing someone, dear sir, or must you find the fresh air before suffocating?
Both. I wish I had never stepped across this threshold.
Did you know she is a remarkable woman?
Oh, yes, I knew.
There you are. She belongs to the future, you know.
Well, the future is welcome to her.
You also go into that future, do you not?
Not if I can help it, sir. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, dear sir.
He crossed the road blindly to the embankment. He stood almost exactly where Mary had stood a few weeks earlier and stared down at the grey river, now close on high tide.
Where do I go from here? I am left feeling as if I'm a child again, as if I must begin to learn to live all over again. 34 years of struggling upwards. All in vain. All in vain. What do I know? What is my authenticity? Only that we act in pursuit of our ends or fail. Sarah always knew that. Now I must learn it.
The river of life, of mysterious laws and mysterious choice, flows past a deserted embankment. And along that other deserted embankment, Charles now begins to pace, a man behind the invisible gun carriage on which rests his own corpse. Does he walk towards an imminent, self-given death? I think not, for he has at last found an atom of faith in himself, a true uniqueness on which to build, and has already begun to. Life, Charles, however advantageously Sarah may seem to fit the role of the Sphinx, is not a symbol. It is not one riddle and one failure to guess it. It is not to be given up after one losing throw of the dice, but is to be, however inadequately, emptily, hopelessly into the city's iron heart, endured. And out again upon the unplumbed salt, estranging sea.
In the final episode of The French Lieutenant's Woman by John Fowles, dramatized by Frederick Bradnam, David Threlfall played Charles Smithson and Amanda Redman, Sarah Woodruff. Norman Rodway was the writer, with Teresa Gallagher as Ernestina, Michael Cochran as Rossetti, and Jason Fleming as Sam. Aunt Tranter was Jill Graham, Mary Una Beeson, Mr. Freeman John Badley, and other parts were played by Rachel Atkins, Geraldine Fitzgerald, John Fleming, and Barry J. Gordon. The pianist was Mary Nash. The director was Janet Whittaker.